This morning, we're going to come to the most difficult, challenging lesson that I will teach in 2 years, because we're dealing with philosophy. And I'm not sure I understand it, but I'm less sure that I know how to teach it. But we've got to deal with it because it is so important with the period of the history of Christianity and what occurred. We have to look at this movement. We have to look at things, how it affected thought, because when thought's affected, culture is affected, then the gospel is affected, the church is affected, and there's a lot of effects. And it's effects that actually extend into today. What happened in this period that we're going to attempt to deal with has its tentacles into the 21st century. And I'll try to tie that together at the end. We actually may even try to look at a YouTube video at the end for about 5 minutes and 16 seconds. The last few weeks we've dealt with the coming of the colonists to America. We saw the city on the hill, the experiment of establishing the Massachusetts Bay Colony, the great and wonderful things that were occurring there. We also saw, prior to that, the movements of the Lord in England itself, with the rise of Puritanism, the truthfulness and the recovery of the gospel in the 17th century. We are out of chronological order, in a sense, because a few weeks back, Brother Paul brought that excellent lesson on German Pietism, which really German Pietism arose in the end of the 17th century, in a sense, as an answer to some of the problems that had begun to exert itself and show itself in the world at large, and particularly the church. The church experienced a decline in religious fervor at the end of the 17th and the beginning of the 18th century. It's documented that much of Christianity had moved in England to a formalism. With the Glorious Restoration of 1689 and the fact that you had an act of toleration and you could worship again, the element that was most fervently religious and evangelical, the Puritan element of the Church of England, was decimated by the fact of lack of ministers and other things, and the vitality did not come back into the church at that time. The church was weakened. It lacked good ministers. It lacked not orthodoxy, but it lacked life. The same thing was occurring on the continent. It was sort of answered on the continent by something we will never deal with. It's something called Protestant orthodoxy, which was a high attempt to answer challenges to Christianity, but it was answered in the academic realm, not necessarily answered in the pulpit and the pew. In America, we saw the wonderful establishment of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. We saw people who devoted themselves to come and build and establish a place to live and to worship according to the way they understood God would have them to worship. We saw that they were successful in establishing the colony. But with the success came some problems. And one of the problems was the fact that the church had I don't want to call it an unholy alliance with the church, with the state, but your fact that to be a full voting member of the state, you need to be a member of the church. And then how are you going to be a member of the church if you're not converted? Well, we're going to make a way for you to get in here so you can have the franchise, so you can vote. These problems led to the decline of religion in New England in just a few 30, 40 years. There was a precipitous decline in what I would call heartfelt experiential religion. And there began to be an influence of deism that was coming in. All right, how are these things possible where truth was? Well, the whole period at the beginning, the end of the 17th and the beginning of the 18th century could be a period that's called Enlightenment and Romanticism. C.S. Lewis called this period the Great Divide. Why did he call it the Great Divide? For one reason, there was a change in philosophy and thought that entered the world, the known world, the Western world, which is the world we're dealing with at this time, that completely altered man's view of life, is really his view of God, his view of religion. Now, the great divide in Christian history was an infusion of new ideas and new forces, forces that we're actually dealing with today. The great divide in Christian history was not the Reformation. True, the Reformation saw a division of Catholicism to Protestantism. It saw a division in Protestantism between the Lutheran, the Reformed, the Anglican, the Anabaptist. But the greatest divide of the 18th century came by the movement called Enlightenment, which was followed by Romanticism. These are ideas that are so prevalent that they're with us today, which I'll try to tie up at the end. Someone has said in a lecture that was on Mars Hill tapes that we are born in the Enlightenment and we are bred in Romanticism. We can't escape it. It is all around us. To look at the Enlightenment, you could begin by looking at three pictures. First, the picture of Voltaire, the Frenchman. You see his dates. The picture of Diderot, who did the first encyclopedia. There's his dates. Thomas Jefferson, we all recognize him. There's his dates. So you see the dates that we're talking about for the period of the Enlightenment is essentially the end of the 17th, beginning of the 18th century through here. If you noticed these men, if you look at them, is there anything similar in all three pictures? I think the similarity may be that they're smiling. You know, you see pictures of men from this period and they sit there, you know, they eat a prune or they, I shouldn't say other things that can cause you to look that way. It's terrible the things that can come through your mind when you really should not say them. But, you know, a lot of things can make you look bad. And, you know, some of the pictures from this time, people look bad. Well, these men look relatively happy. They have a smile on their face. Kenneth Clark, in his history called Civilization, says that these men had the smile of reason. Did I put that up? Yeah, the smile of reason. What in the world is the smile of reason? They think that they and others like them are on to the answer at last to human life, and that every problem of human life will be solved as mankind now uses reason to solve the problems of the world. Man has entered into a period where he's throwing off his past constraints. And if you're throwing off your past constraints, that would be the king. That would be the government, to a sense. It certainly would be the church, because the church and its claims of supernaturalism and its claims of authority has held man down. But now man has the ability to use his mind. He is going to be freed because of this. The Enlightenment could be described and defined as a self-conscious break with traditional values and authority, producing a new intellectual climate in which reason was enthroned. I think that's the best succinct definition you can say. Man threw off what had bound him, and it was a self-conscious putting it off, and a moving to an enthronement of reason. I tried to make reason a little larger and darker. I don't know that I did. Dr. Frank James, in his History of Christianity, Frank James is professor and I think president of Reformed Seminary in Orlando. And you can download from RTS online his lectures on History of Christianity, which I've done. He got the definition, which was better than what I had, so I took his. The Enlightenment was a period. If you want to put dates on it, it actually is dated by most scholars as beginning at 1648 and ending at 1789. With the Peace of Westphalia from that period up through the French Revolution was the period that the Enlightenment burst onto the scene. The Enlightenment came from many disciplines. It didn't come just from one. It came from many. It came from not the church, but it came from philosophy. It came from mathematics. It came from science. In fact, when you talk about the Enlightenment, we can say that there's two elements in the Enlightenment. The first element being the promise of science. It was thought at this time, with the advent of modern science, that man would now be able to have the answers to things he had not known before. The most prominent scientist at this time was Isaac Newton. Newton, in writing his book called The Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica, and I practiced that so I could get through it. Anyway, notice it's written in Latin. It was his Principles of Mathematics. This was a physics text that opened up ideas of science and mathematics. It was phenomenal what Newton did in this. How high was Newton regarded? Alexander Pope said, "Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light." People considered that Isaac Newton opened the door to knowledge. He opened the door to understanding. And we will take this understanding and we'll take this knowledge and we'll apply it to things, apply it to problems, and man will progress. Now, Newton was an Orthodox Christian, but people took from what he said and the hope that came from this, and they believed that a new age was coming, an age of not only of reason, but of, they thought, an age of technology. And there was great technological advances and scientific advances. And these advances, some have said, have continued up to the present day. And, you know, the advances have. But for the 300 years since, Chaim Potok, a Jewish writer, said, "For the past 300 years, the umbrella civilization of Western man has been modern paganism or secular humanism. It's probably the most creative, the most liberated, the wealthiest, most dehumanizing, and most murderous civilization in the history of our species." That is what we've seen for the last 300 years. And the Enlightenment ushered this in for us. Reason and exalting man ushered this in for us. Newton wrote in Latin. Few scholars could read him. Voltaire translated him into the vernacular there. Why? So that his teaching could be propagandized to the masses. The one element of the Enlightenment was the fact that the teachings of the philosophers were put in the common vernacular so that the common man would be impacted by this. Not only was the promise of science, but you had the progress of philosophy. Philosophy began to be viewed as a new discipline. Prior to this time, philosophy, whether it be Aristotelian or Platonic, had been viewed as an asset for the church to the support of Christianity. Philosophy had not been the queen of sciences in its own self. Now it was. There were two approaches to science, to philosophy, one on the continent, one on the British Isles, in the British Isles. The continental approach to philosophy could be put under the title of the rationalism of Descartes. René Descartes, 1596 to 1650, French philosopher. Descartes said that he began with the human mind. Literally, he was saying his own mind. And he figured out everything from his own mind. He began with what he could think. He eliminated everything else. And then he got down to the basic rock of reality. Now, if he eliminated everything but what he could think, then obviously what he developed was what he could think, which was out of his own mind. Okay. Wow. He doubted everything else. It was methodical doubt. Methodical doubt would be what you would say, because Descartes said, if I can't understand it, if I can't reason it, if I can't grasp it, then, you know, I just doubt that it exists. He began with the human mind. He said he could think his way to God. Lord Byron, who was an Englishman, said that like a spider producing cobwebs from his own mind was the thought of Descartes. Didn't think much, the British did. The British were hard-headed. They wanted an approach to philosophy that was different than Descartes. They wanted an approach that could be simplified by the empiricism of John Locke. John Locke, you see his date, 1632 to 1704. John Locke taught that you should begin with the external world. The human mind would observe and organize the data that came to it from the external observable world. You could take this knowledge and that you could observe, and then you could develop systems from it. You could develop a way to think, a way to act, a way to live. Locke said that there were three ways to arrive at knowledge. And Locke was a religious man. He wasn't irreligious. He wanted to arrive at religious knowledge. He said religious knowledge could be acquired according to reason. You could observe that God existed, that God was good, God was nice, and we ought to be nice too. These are elements of religion that you can observe by reason. So knowledge comes by observation. But he also said that there was a knowledge above reason, supernatural. Locke accepted the resurrection. Couldn't understand it, but he said obviously it existed. But he said there was knowledge contrary to reason, and this you couldn't accept. He began to have doubts about the Trinity. As he tried to examine it, he couldn't understand it, and he felt he had to reject it. He had increasing doubts about the exclusivity of Christ. As he examined religion, Locke said, okay, God is fair. God is good. If men who have never heard about Jesus, but are moral men and try to do good, certainly God will take them to his heaven. Because it wouldn't be fair if God didn't do that. So the empiricism of Locke in his examination of the facts led him to conclude that God had to be fair. Therefore, there were more ways to be pleasing to God than through Jesus Christ. Locke said he was not a thinker, but an investigator. He received, he organized truth as he understood it. There were different approaches to philosophy, obviously, between Descartes and Locke. One says you approach things with your eyes closed. You think out the truth. Locke says you approach it with your eyes open. You look in the microscope or the telescope to discover real stuff through empirical observation. And then you draw your conclusions. But whether you begin with the mind of Descartes or the investigative thinking of Locke, they arrived at the same conclusion, the growing autonomy of human reason. Reason was the main thing. If you could not acquire truth by reason, it was not truth that you could have. The new focus of philosophy, human focus and rationality, but no longer the Bible. Locke wrote something called the Tabula Rasa, which he said the mind was like a blank, or the human being was like a blank tablet. And that you could write on this tablet things by the environment and by training, and that changed the tablet into good or to bad. This is the same thing that I remember being taught in educational philosophy at Elon University, is that, you know, man is born neutral, and what you pour into him makes him what he is. It's a rejection of, obviously a rejection of depravity, because the belief that man is born absolutely neutral. This came from John Locke. He said it's neutral. But if you're neutral, you have the ability to shape that to make it better. There was an optimism that was a part of these men. They believed that things could be getting better and could be gotten better by man's effort. They were not pessimists. They were optimists. These early scientists were not faithless men. I said that Newton was a devout Christian. Newton wrote a commentary on Daniel. One Englishman says, "Why are you wasting your time?" But Newton said in studying the Bible, he was thinking God's thoughts after him. He saw no clash in Bible study and scientific inquiry to Newton. But it was a clash to others because they were not willing to accept the supernatural. In fact, the Enlightenment was an absolute rejection of the supernatural. The Enlightenment gave rise to a humanistic, secular view of the world. Dr. Schaefer says that from this time, you move from modern to modern science, a battle between science and the Bible. It rose at this time. From this time of the Enlightenment is really when modernity, as they call it, began. Modern age began with the Enlightenment. In John Locke's The Reasonableness of Christianity, he explained Christianity to the point that the miracles disappeared. There were no reason for the miracles. You couldn't understand them. They must have happened some way man just misunderstood. They wanted to teach morality. In fact, there was a central theme of morality through the Enlightenment writers. William Tyndale wrote something called Christianity as Old as Creation. This gentleman was really something, and his Christianity as Old as Creation. Let me read, let me find my notes on him. He said, God must, as he understood it, I called him William, it's Matthew Tyndale. You didn't know the difference. He said, God must dispense his truth equally to all men at all times. God must be fair, as I understand fairness. And it just wouldn't be fair if he didn't do that. Anything else was wrong. Nothing can be allowed in our religion except that which reason allows. He rejects orthodox doctrine. He says that all your beliefs must be judged as whether or not they promote man's happiness. The purpose of creation is man would be happy. Think that's with us today? That everybody's supposed to be happy? Contrast a view of man being created to be happy and man being created to glorify God. Luther, in his examination, said that happiness, I hope, happens. Morality, I hope, happens. Truth must happen. But for Tyndale, he said, no, we got to focus on happiness. And any religion that doesn't lead to men being happy must be a false religion. Well, y'all got enough sense to judge that. Another person who wrote it this time, remember Thomas Jefferson, our third president, and the little book he wrote called The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth? He took his penknife, if you remember the story, and he literally excised from the New Testament all the miraculous events in Jesus' life. He took his penknife and he cut out what he didn't like and he pasted together what he did. And you can see that Bible. It's either in the Smithsonian or at Monticello today. Do you remember, Earl, where it is? I'm not sure either. I did know, but it exists today, and you can see. Beloved, that was a lot of effort. He was serious about religion to go to the trouble to do that. He wasn't rejecting religion, but he wanted religion and God to be in his image rather than it being in God's image and what God was saying. His image, his idea, his reason was dominant and should be. This whole move through Enlightenment leads to something that is called deism. Deism simply, Lord Sidney Herbert of Cherbourg was the first person that they say is the first deist. Lord Herbert, I think I had a quote from him. In essence, he says, God exists. God is good and he's nice. We should be nice too. That was his view of God. John Tolan, Christianity not mysterious. God exists. God is nice. We are too. God exists. Voltaire was the one that used the phrase as a watchmaker. God created the world very powerfully now. He set it in motion. He said everything that the world needed was done at creation. And then he removed himself from it. And he's allowing the world to operate under natural law. Yeah, he set it in force. But he is not there. He is away from the world. The deists were saying, we admit God exists. And the God that exists is a good God. And that means we should be good people. Lord Cherbourg, Lord Herbert said, you know, if you're good people, then you can go to where God is. I wish I could find the quote from him anyway. It's somewhere. I tell you, this is hard stuff. What was this going to work? Was this going to be the future of Christianity? Well, deism was a religion, but is it going to be the future of Christianity? Some thought, no, that there should be an answer to this. David Hume, the Scottish philosopher, introduced something called the frown of reason. He said that you cannot really trust your impressions or your senses, because what goes on inside the mind may not correspond to what is out there. He said the deists have a problem because they have such a confidence in their mind. And you can't really know if what you're thinking is actually out there. He said what you're seeing, Hume said, may not really be out there. Some said of Hume, though, that when he was walking down the street in Edinburgh, that if a limb was hanging out, he ducked, because his philosophy that said it may be there, it may not be real, told him the limb was going to hit his head. So, you know, he didn't actually live out his doubting philosophy, but Hume was doubting. He wasn't really sure. A fellow Scot named Thomas Reed developed Scottish sense philosophy, or Scottish sense realism, as an answer to the skepticism of Hume's philosophy. But after Hume, people were not confident. Hume introduced skepticism, and it kind of created what someone has called a big ugly ditch. That is, the parts of history that are difficult. Voltaire, the French Enlightenment thinker, was struck and upset because there was an earthquake in Lisbon, and it caused devastation. And he couldn't reconcile this to a good world. 1774, Voltaire took a friend, and they went up on a mountain at sunrise. When the sun came up, Voltaire, it says, fell on his knees and says, "Oh, you are a great God, but I'm not sure about your son." That's another thing. And, you know, he wanted to see a great God and a good world, and he could reasonably accept that, but now there were problems in the world. There were earthquakes. There was death. What's man going to do? How is man going to balance these things out? Well, there was another movement that came alongside the Enlightenment. It was different, but it was like it. It was the movement of Romanticism. The Romantic Creed, here's the Philippe Rousseau, the Frenchman. The Romantic Creed, I feel, therefore I am. The defining moment for Romanticism, Rousseau was on an island in a lake. He said he felt himself one with nature. I feel. Since I have feelings, obviously I exist. The Romantic Creed is the importance of feelings. The importance of feelings, I just can't tell you. That's just must be really real to them. You know, their experiences were just special. The sanctity of nature. Well, those two things came up. For the Romantic, he viewed God as being real close. Real close. God was everywhere. Pantheism came out of Romanticism. He said the deist had a God that was way off. The Romantic had a God that was close, but he was close in things. He was close everywhere. Pantheism comes out of Romanticism. Wordsworth talked about the divinity of nature. The role of the artist. The artist stands, someone said, as mankind, on mankind like a statue on its pedestal. Only an artist can divine the meaning of life. They elevated the position of the artist. Romantic religion can be found in a number of expressions. Immanuel Kant, he says religion operates within the limits of reason. He talked about you had to look within yourself and you had to find hope there. Another one at this time was Friedrich Schleiermacher. Schleiermacher emphasized a inter-religion. Religion comes not from the mind or the Bible, but it comes from your inner feelings of absolute dependence. Subjective theology. How I feel is therefore how I think and how I believe. Schleiermacher also was the father of higher criticism, which we'll deal with a month or so on down the road. But he's moving all of theology from objective orthodox truth to subjective perceptions of truth. If I don't really feel it, then it really must not be. This opens the door to the subjective theology, opens the door to transcendentalism. Our famous American transcendentalist, Ralph Waldo Emerson. Believe it or not, Ralph Waldo Emerson was a trained theologian, but his views became so far afield that even the Unitarians kicked him out. And if the Unitarians kick you out, that's pretty bad. There's no doubt about that. He said that there was a fire within, and that fire was in was what was driving him. Oh, and he also said the phrase, obey thyself. The transcendentalism of him, of Emerson, all of enlightenment mentality, it leads to what someone has called a split personality. Until we are brought under the authority of Christ, we really don't know who we are. The enlightenment mentality, and the phrase of the enlightenment, as Dr. Schaefer would say, would be, give me till tomorrow. The enlightenment person thought they could change anything. Dr. James says there's several words that epitomize the enlightenment. One of them, obviously, is reason. Another word is optimism. The people thought that a better day was coming. They really did think a better day was coming and they could introduce this. We're living with the effects of the romantic ideas today. We may be solving problems, but we must live according to our own desires. That's another thing that the Enlightenment said, was that the autonomy of the man. The individual is autonomous. The individual is not responsible to anyone else. They need to obey themselves. An illustration was given of a little 4 or 5 year old girl whose parents told her to do something to obey them. And she looked and she says, but I want to obey myself. You know, any parent or grandparent here knows that that is the expression of a child. I want to obey myself. I want to be my own ruler. The Enlightenment and Romantic produced a person who was saying that, I want to be my own God. Now, the Enlightenment and Romanticism, in introducing thought, said that when man realized that reason was king, that reason would open truth and would shine like a light. What was Livingston's quote about this that was so good about the light coming in? The light of reason could cast its light into the darkness of superstition, and reason could bring man true enlightenment and happiness. Reason could do this. Now, do you remember a promise that was made to someone that if they did a particular thing, this amount of light and knowledge would be given to that person? Three-letter word, Eve. She was told if she ate of this fruit, she would then have the knowledge. Well, the enlightened romanticist reason person saying the same thing. If you apply your reason, it's just going to give you light. Then you'll know. Don't know about that. Anyway, obey thyself, as Emerson said. This is a philosophy that took a pretty good hit in World War I because the world was not getting better. They saw the horrors of war. Poem by W.H. Auden, faces along the bar cling to the average day. The lights must never go out. The music must always play. All the conventions conspired to make this fort assume the furniture of home. Lest we should see where we are, lost in a haunted wood, children afraid of the night who have never been happy or good. That was written at the end of the 1930s because they had just witnessed a decade of devastation from the Depression to Hitler's march across Czechoslovakia into Poland. It was a terrible time. Man's never been happy. Man's never been good. One would expect, it's a paragraph I've written, one would expect with the rise of naturalism, nationalism, rationalism, romanticism, and all the ugly stepchildren that it spawned, both in the church and the society at large, that the 18th century would be a time of deadness and departure from the truth. That was true in a broad sense. But the Spirit of God was moving and did move in the 18th century. The next 3 weeks, we're going to be dealing with the Spirit of the Lord moving. We're going to be dealing with matters of revival. Revival throughout Western Europe, the British Isles, and North America, North American colonies. Revival that would lead to so eminent a theologian and preacher as Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones to write, go to the 18th century, read the stories of the great tides and movements of the Spirit experienced in that century. For a preacher, it's absolutely invaluable. With the loss of confidence in religion, with the deadness that had entered the church, what was the church's response? The church probably didn't respond in any organized way very, very good. Maybe the response of Pietism in Germany was a response to the deadness around it. But in the British Isles, there was really no good response. But God, in His providence and in His sovereignty, intervened and sent revival and dealt with the church. Dr. Calhoun says that if you examine the history, you would have to say the church's response to the changes in culture were not good. But God overrode the inefficiency of the church's response, and He sent revival. What should be our response to challenges and changes today? Did anyone click on to the little YouTube thing that I put in the lesson? Okay. Well, I'm going to play it because this really impacted me. Tom Askell, Dr. Tom Askell, Pastor Tom Askell, has been dealing in the last couple of years a lot with what is the gospel and how do you share it. He's challenged with the fact that there have been such moves in society and in culture, rapid moves in the last 10 to 12. We're in a period of exponential growth and knowledge and things like that. We do not compromise the gospel and we do not change the gospel, but we take the gospel and we apply it in the society and in the time that we live. What are we going to do with the gospel? How are we going to answer the changes that is happening in the world today? Are we going to go live over in a corner and say we did it great in 1990 or 1966 or somewhere like that? Are we going to face that we're in a rapidly changing world? And what are we going to do to take the gospel to that world? Now, I don't have an answer for that, but I want to play this little YouTube thing if I can hit the right button and make it play, because the title is Do You Know? And all it's doing is talking about, and really it's writing, you got to read it, more of the fact of the changes in the amount of knowledge and how it's impacting us. Okay, let me see if I can, I'll bring that back up. As Dr. Askell puts up the scriptures, we are not to be discouraged. I, the Lord, do not change. Therefore, you, O children of Jacob, are not consumed. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And as the verse we end a lot of these lessons with, the grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever. But the word of the Lord remains forever, and this word is the good news that was preached to you. Now, are we to be afraid of change? No. How do we embrace change? How do we respond to it? I don't have the answers, but I tell you, beloved, we better be asking the question. Because the world is changing. If you remember what Pastor Hendricks said within the last year, I think, when he was talking about the preaching of the gospel and the focus of the preaching of the gospel, and he made the statement that I didn't think I would ever live to hear Gary Hendricks say, that probably if people are going to hear me preach the gospel, it's going to be outside of these walls because they're not coming in here. And, you know, really, people aren't coming into church buildings today unless it's to be entertained. We have to take, and we are attempting to take the gospel. We're not denigrating preaching by any stretch of the imagination, but we are attempting to take the gospel into the culture in many different ways. It just struck me that the church failed to respond to the Enlightenment and Romanticism. But the Lord was gracious in sending revival. Are we going to fail to respond to the changes that are happening? Are we going to fail to respond to India growing the way it is? Are we going to be like a young man I know who's a graduate of Bethlehem Institute, has his MDiv from Southern Seminary, feels called to labor in northern India in one of the most dangerous places in the world to labor, to the point that he has sought out an Indian bride to go with him. And he is Caucasian as me and you. But he knows if he's going there with a wife, she probably needs to be an Indian wife, and it seems the Lord has given him one. But he believes that he is called to go there into that culture, taking the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, in technology, the availability of the internet in China, and that there are going to be methods and means of getting truth to the churches and instruction that didn't exist 10 years ago. We have to use these technologies and not be afraid of them. The world is changing. It changed in the 18th century. The Lord was gracious to send the church revival. The church didn't deserve it because it didn't really respond and answer the changes that were happening that good. What is he going to do for us? How are we going to respond to the changes? Anyway, we have a little extra time. Gives you more of a break. God bless you. Next week, we're going to do the evangelical awakening in England. We get back to church history. Thank you so much.